All right, we begin a new trimester this evening and studying the book of Leviticus. We have studied the book of Exodus, Genesis and Exodus. And always in my mind, as I begin a new book, where does it fit in the Bible library? And this is part of the Pentateuch, that is the books of Moses, the first five books of the Old Testament, the books of the law. And so it fits in that section. In fact, the first word of Leviticus in the King James says, and, which suggests this is a continuation of the thought of the book of Leviticus, of the book of Exodus. The New King James uses the word, now the Lord called Moses, but some have suggested this is a continuation of the thought of what we have seen in the previous book, perhaps so. Now, let's talk about the book of the law that we have been talking about in Genesis and in Exodus. The body of material that is found from Genesis to Deuteronomy, those five books, are always treated in the Old Testament and New Testament, for that matter, as a single book. I don't mean by that it's wrong to view them as different books. As we have over here in this little diagram, we view them as separate books. Here's Genesis, and then here's another book, Exodus, and here's another book, Leviticus, and on down the line. But in the Old Testament, it's referred to as the book of Moses. We won't take the time to trace those. 2 Chronicles 25, 2 Chronicles 35, Ezra 6, Nehemiah 13, even in the New Testament, Matthew or Mark 12. So the book of Moses, not the books, but the book of Moses, they were pulled together as one, the book of Moses. Referred to as the book of the law in Joshua 1, and also 2 Kings 22 and 2 Chronicles and Nehemiah 8 and Galatians 3. The law, that is the Torah, is the teaching of God. Now, there are other books that are the teaching of God too, but this is the law. This is the law section. And so is there law that is presented in, for example, the historical books, as we just looked at just a moment ago right here? As we get to these historical books, or even the poetry or prophecy, and there is. But primarily, the emphasis of Genesis through Deuteronomy has to do with the law. Make sense? So in this trimester, we're looking at Leviticus and then Numbers, and Deuteronomy will be a trimester within itself. Now, let's see where this fits in the timeline or the time scale. This is a time scale that I don't normally look at, but I like this one for this point. This is taken from Bible Manna. Starting with Adam, we come all the way down to the time of Noah and the flood, and you see the flood here with this vertical line. And then we come on down to the time of Jacob, and then they go into Egypt. And now we come to the time of Moses, and this line right here is where the books of Moses would fit. Now, they describe the period from Genesis 1 creation, but what we're reading in the book of Leviticus fits into this period right here to kind of give you a visual of where we're fitting and about the time frame wherein these books will fit. All right, let's talk about some introductory things to the book of Leviticus, and then we'll get underway in chapters 1 through 4. The author is Moses, and we know that because quotations from the Old Testament of the book, meaning Genesis through Deuteronomy, the book, are referred to as being from Moses. We just saw it was called the book of Moses. But Romans 4 quotes from Leviticus 18 and accredits Moses with writing Leviticus 18. So that tells me Moses wrote the book of Leviticus. Same thing we see in Luke chapter 2. We see the same thing in John 8. So here are references from either another section of the Pentateuch or Leviticus itself. Moses is credited with that. The law was given at Sinai, but here in chapter 1, that is, much of the Pentateuch was given at Sinai, like the book of Exodus, but this was delivered at the door of the tabernacle after it was erected. Remember, we saw it being erected at the end of the book of Exodus, chapter 1, verse 1, at the door of the tabernacle, he spoke, saying, and here are the instructions concerning these sacrifices. All right, let's give a summary of the books. Genesis that we've already covered, Exodus we've already covered. God building a nation is the emphasis of the book of Genesis. Is there more to it than that? Yes. But that's the emphasis of Genesis. God builds a nation through whom the Messiah is going to come. Well, the book of Exodus is God delivers them and gives them a law. God delivers that nation. Well, in the book of Leviticus, we have the carrying out of the services of the Levitical priesthood. And this is part of God preserving that nation and holding that nation and keeping that nation through whom the Messiah is going to come. Does that make sense? So you say, well, I don't really get to understand all the requirements and all the laws and all the emphasis in the book of Leviticus. Much of that has to do with God preserving this nation through whom the Messiah is going to come. Now, the name simply means, Leviticus means pertaining to the Levites. So obviously, you see the Levites, Leviticus, it pertains to the Levites. You say, you're not a Levite, so it doesn't pertain to you. Well, it does pertain to you because through the Levitical priesthood, ultimately comes the ushering in of, I don't mean that the Messiah came from the tribe of Levi, but through that Levitical priesthood serving as the type and the shadow of greater things to come, we have the ushering in of the Messiah's kingdom. So it does pertain to us in that sense. Now the Levites were one of the 12 tribes, obviously. Aaron and his sons were priests. They took care of the tabernacle. They were supported by tithes, given 48 cities to live in, according to Numbers 35 and Joshua chapter 21. Let's talk about the contents of the book. What are we going to see? Hopefully we can make this as interesting as possible. I've said before, this is no disrespect to the book of God, but reading Leviticus sometimes is like reading a phone book. There is essential information there that we need to know. For example, the Day of Atonement would mean nothing to us if we didn't have Leviticus 16. But it is like reading a phone book at times. But we need to get that information and so that we better understand other things on down the line. Exodus and so are Numbers, both in Deuteronomy, more interesting to us perhaps than Leviticus, but it's a necessary book. So what's in this book? Well, it's a system of laws. We're going to see civil and sanitary and religious and moral laws. We're going to see, one writer called this a guide or a manual for priests. So if you could picture yourself being a high priest or one of the priests serving under the high priest, you say, how do we go about all of this? The book of Leviticus is your manual. It's going to tell you how to do it. And when this sacrifice is done, you're going to take blood into the tabernacle. When this sacrifice is made, you're not taking that blood in there. We're going to see all of that even in our study tonight. There's great emphasis on worship more than any of the other books of the Pentateuch. There's emphasis on purity and holiness and being holy that's used some 80 times in the book. We're going to see gift offerings. We start with that in chapters 1 to 4, the burnt offering, grain offering, peace offering, sin offering. Chapter 5 will deal with the trespass offering. We're going to see the various feasts like the Sabbath and the Passover and the Pentecost and the Feast of the Tabernacle and the Atonement, Leviticus 16. There are three annual feasts that we talk about often, the Passover, the Feast of Pentecost, and the Feast of Ingatherings or Dwelling in Booths. The starting, even though that had been mentioned in the book of Exodus, we see the execution, but maybe the better word for point number D there, the institution or the execution of the priesthood, that is, that comes into play. Very little historical information is found here. It's going to be more of this sacrifice is to be offered this way, and if this circumstance arises, here's the law, etc., etc. Make sense? Now you understand why if you're not very familiar with Leviticus, I say it's much like reading a phone book. All right, I want to present three different outlines here of the book. And I think each one of them have a little different connotation and give a little different emphasis. This outline presents it as verses chapters 1 through 7 deals with offerings and sacrifices. So we're going to see a lot of those like burnt offering and peace offering, grain offering, etc. We're going to see all of that in chapters 1 to 7. We'll focus on the priesthood in 8 through 10. 11 to 15 will talk about laws for daily living, things that are clean and unclean. The Day of Atonement, chapter 16, I've already mentioned that several times. And then there's a whole passel of miscellaneous laws. I won't read all of that list, but like the customs of the heathens are to be forbidden, their feasts, their Sabbath, Jubilee, their vows, rules for priests, etc., laws for holiness. All of that's going to be dealt with from chapter 17 on. Make sense? I like this outline here. I like Wiersbe's material. I like the way he outlines chapters 1 to 10, God's provision for sin. There's the sacrifice and the priesthood. God's precepts for separation. There's a holy nation, a holy priesthood, holy days. Then there's the promise for success, the Sabbath of the land, the importance of obedience, and the seriousness of vows. Pretty good outline. Captures the thought, I think, of the book. Some of you are familiar with Blackmore. If you have the Garden of Truth series, Evan and I believe her name is Marie, a man and his wife from Australia, put together a commentary on Leviticus and two volumes on Psalms. And that's the Blackmore I refer to. They're members of the body of Christ. But anyway, he just gives two points. The tabernacle and the priesthood are prepared, and then here's diverse laws. Kind of a brief outline. I like Wiersbe perhaps better. Let's talk about extremes to be avoided before we get to chapter 1. One extreme is looking at Leviticus as it only pertains to the people of the Old Testament and never see the type of Christ in the sacrifices that are made. And yet, the book of Hebrews tells us that was a type and a shadow of the greater to come. So that's one extreme. We just look at it, that this is what they did in the Old Testament. It has nothing to do with us at all. And if it has nothing to do with us, then when we get to Hebrews, then it means nothing that we have a great high priest and that we are priests and there's entering into the Holy of Holies. What is the Holy of Holies? You don't have a clue if we don't have knowledge of the Old Testament. The other extreme here on the other side is looking at Leviticus and seeing Christ and his kingdom in every detail of Leviticus. Some have done that. So that every reference is some kind of parallel, and it was not intended to be such. Had that been the case, I think the Hebrew writer would have known that and would have flagged that for us. All right. Now let's get underway with chapters 1 to 4. Let's go to question 1. Oh, by the way, before I forget it, some of you are on an email list that I send out, and you've asked to be on that, and if you want to be on, you can be, and this, you just need to email me and let me know, where you receive the slides in two formats, PDF and in PowerPoint, of everything we present, whether Sunday morning or Wednesday night. Those who are on the email list got an additional PDF. About 12 years ago, our own Doug Purdom, put together a system charts of the sacrifices of chapters 1 to 7, where he breaks down, I know you can't see, but he breaks down from the type of the offering, the purpose of the offering, the animal, what the priest was to do, what the individual was to do, and what was the result. Did an excellent job with that. He spent a lot of time on that. That is in PDF format. Those of you on the email list got that tonight. If you want that, email me and you'll get that. And if you want to be on the list, let me know. And that includes people who listen online. Email me and you can get that list. All right, question number 1. What's chapter 1 about? Burnt offerings. Various burnt offerings. Chapter 2, what's it about? Grain offerings. Chapter 3, peace offerings. And chapter 4, sin offerings. Now, you're going to see all the information you see on the slide here. You're going to see those parallel verses in a moment. So don't worry about copying those down just yet if you don't already have those. We'll flag those as we go along. That's chapters 1 to 4. Now, just a little reminder of the tabernacle. We'll talk about this more in a moment. And this is the brazen altar, or the altar of burnt offerings that we're going to see in our study tonight. There is the altar of incense on the inside that we'll talk about of the tabernacle. And I've just flagged the direction because there's going to be some information about the northern side and the eastern side, western side, etc., concerning the sacrifices. And we'll come back to that here in a moment. All right, here's chapter 1. Chapter 1 is about the burnt offering. So let's go to question 2. What is the burnt offering, or what was the burnt offering? All right. What else?
It was an atonement for sins with the blood.
All right. Very good. Did everyone offer the same sacrifice? Not necessarily. There seems to be a choice here. Of the herd means of their bulls, and so of their cattle they could offer a sacrifice, or they could offer of their flock, and we'll see what that was, a sheep or of a goat, verse 10, or of birds. So what was the significant difference in those? It seems to be a matter of choice based upon what they had or what they could afford. One would bring perhaps their bull to offer, and another one would bring their goat or their sheep because they couldn't afford a bull or didn't have a bull. But those that didn't have either of those, they could always bring a turtle dove or some bird that's mentioned here in this context. Make sense? So I don't think that meant you were to offer the bull, and then you offer also this, and then you need to offer that as well. I think it was a matter of choice. And my reason for saying that is because of the wording, for example, at verse 10, and if his offering is that of the flocks. All right, let's get underway here at chapter 1. Each one of these sacrifices has to do with what they did and then how they were to do that. And we'll see that all the way through. Now, this would be a good time to flag a parallel verse where more information is given. Some of it's repetitive, and we've made this point time and again. If God repeats something, there's some value in that. So we're going, when we get to chapter 6 next time, we're going to be talking about the burnt offerings again. But there'll be some information there, so this would be a good time to mark in the margin of your text here beside the burnt offerings of chapter 1. Chapter 6, 8 through 13 gives us a little more information. When we get over there, guess what we're going to do? We're going to flag this chapter and come back. All right, let's get underway. God called Moses to the door of the tabernacle, our tabernacle of meeting, and said, here's what you're going to tell the people. And I'm paraphrasing that, of course. Speak to the children of Israel. If anyone brings an offering, and if his offering is, I'm at verse 3, is a burnt offering of the herd, what are the qualities that he's to bring? To be a male, and he's to be without blemish. What does that tell you? God wants the best. And so it's to be, whether male or female, we'll see female a little bit later in some of the sacrifices, it was to be without blemish. In other words, don't root around and find the worst animal you got, the sicklest animal you got, and I can give that away because he's probably going to die anyway, and I'll give that to the Lord. You give the one without blemish. Pick out the best you've got. It's true sacrifice. And we're going to see something about a point of that in a moment. There's another element about what he's to offer. It is to be given of his own free will. In other words, not force, not the priest coming along, you need to sacrifice that bull. I know you wanted to give this one, but I want you to give that one. That's not the case. He gives it of his own free will, and he brings it to the door. Now, what does he do beginning at verse 4? He puts his hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it will be accepted on his behalf. In other words, this is going to be offered on his behalf to make atonement. It's a New Testament term. It's an Old Testament term. The word literally means to cover. And so to make atonement means to cover for his sins. Now, we know from the New Testament references, like Hebrews 10:4, the blood of bulls and goats never took away sin at all. It was remembered again every year. It was based on the coming sacrifice, but this was to make atonement for their sin, and we understand how that was done. Now, when we come to verse 9, I want to wait till we get to verse 9. I think there's an implication of the purpose of what's being accomplished other than just the atonement. Then he's going to kill the bull, and he brings it to the priest, and then what's going to happen? And this is that altar of burnt offerings out in front of the tabernacle. And he's going to spread that around that. And he'll take the skin of the burnt offering and cut it in pieces. And then what are the sons of Aaron going to do? Yeah, they're going to build a fire on the altar and put the wood on it. And the priest of Aaron shall lay the parts, the head and the fat, in order on the wood. And they'll wash its entrails and legs. And they'll burn it as a burnt sacrifice. And this comes up, and this is repeated time and again, a sweet aroma to the Lord. What does that suggest to you? Yeah, I don't think it suggests the idea that burning meat smells great. But this is a sweet aroma to the Lord suggests God's very pleased with that. This is a very pleasant thing in the sight of God for God. This is acceptable, makes you acceptable before God. This comes up before God as a sweet aroma before God. God doesn't have literal nostrils wherein he smells the aroma. It's the idea of we're honoring and praising God and it's acceptable before God. So let's go to verse 9 now. That when he washes its entrails and its legs in water, and the priest shall burn all on the altar. That suggests this wholeness. It seems to be that this burnt offering, that it serves as a symbolism of complete surrender of the worshiper. that this was a matter he burns at all. This was not one of the sacrifices where the priests keep back part, but they're burning it all. Does that make sense? So here is complete surrender to God, giving your best to God. So every time they make this offering of burnt offering, sacrifice of burnt offering, it is a sacrifice of the wholeness, and it makes atonement, but it's symbolic of this whole complete surrender to the will of God. All right, let's go to the flocks. Now, beginning at verse 10, what's to be offered, verse 10? It could be sheep, or it could be of a goat. What about the quality? Without blemish, without defect. Again, God deserves and wants the best of our service, not what's left over. All right, now we can move a little quicker through this because this basically says the same thing, that he's going to kill it on the north side of the altar. The north side, if you're facing the door of the tabernacle, the north side would be to your right. All right, he's going to offer it on the north side of the altar before the Lord, and they're going to sprinkle the blood. What else is going to happen? Do the same thing, yes, and wash all the entrails, and then they burn it all as a sacrifice, and it comes as a sweet-smelling aroma before the Lord. All right, so he could offer of the herd, his bull, or he could offer of a sheep or a goat, and then there's another alternative here, and that's the case of baby, though not mentioned specifically here. Other places mention those who are poor. He could offer a bird, and he brings his offering of what? What could it be? Turtle doves or young pigeons, much cheaper for those who are poor. When we come to New Testament times, when Jesus was cleansing the temple, they were buying and selling, and you could purchase your turtle dove or your pigeon there that you might offer it before God. Well, now what happens to it? What do they do with it? Bring it to the altar, and they kill it. The New King James says, "Ring off its head." Literally, to nip it or chop it off is what that means. I don't know that it meant they wrung it off, but they were to sever the head and to drain the blood by the side of the altar. They were to remove its crop with its feathers and cast it to the side of the altar then what else? They were to split it, but not tear it completely in two. And it was also to be sacrificed completely before the Lord, and that comes up as a sweet-smelling aroma. All right, now I know that's a hurried look through that, but we've got more chapters to go through, and our time's clipping along. So if you haven't already taken a peek over to chapter 6, you might just take a peek over there to chapter 6, beginning at verse 8 through verse 13. We're not going to read that, but here's the law of the burnt offering. You see some information there. For example, at verse 13, you see a little bit of information there that's not mentioned in our text here. We'll capture that in our study next time. All right, that's the law of the burnt offering. So when we come to burnt offerings, what the value of Leviticus is, we just read the manual for that. And whether you remember 3 months from now what the manual said, when the law of burnt offering comes up, then we'll be flagged to go back to Leviticus 1 and say, okay, here's where the law is. So we know what's going on. Make sense? All right, now what do we have in chapter 2? The grain offering. Now, for what it's worth to you, notice at verse 1, if you have the King James, it'll say a meat offering. And I think that's an unfortunate translation of that because that really changes the idea of the grain to flesh. And I know it wasn't flesh because the context talks about grain and talks about bringing of their grain. So it's not meat, it's not flesh, it is. Probably they were using the term meat in the sense of food is really the idea of their translation. I don't know that that was a mistranslation as much as it is an unfortunate translation. But they bring a grain offering. Now here's what we have. We have the grain offering, and then the next three sections are the grain offering that's cooked. So it seems that verses 1 to 3 is talking about a grain offering that is uncooked. Now, if you want to flag chapter 6, 14 to 23 is the parallel account. We'll get to that later, not at this juncture. So what were they to do? They were to take, bring an offering of what? Verse 1. Fine flour, and they're to pour oil on it and put incense on it and bring it to Aaron, and they take a handful of that. What do they do with it? He will take a handful of it and all the frankincense, and they shall burn it as, in other words, a portion of it they're going to burn as a memorial on the altar made by fire. And it's a sweet-smelling aroma. But the rest of it could be done, what would be done with it, verse 3? Yeah, the priest could eat that. They could take that and eat that. That's part of how they were taken care of, is by the sacrifices that people brought. So that seemingly is an uncooked portion of this grain offering, if you bring a grain offering to the Lord. And there's a purpose behind all of this. And I take it, as we're going to see, perhaps as we get to verses 7 through 10, we'll see this a little more, but let's talk about the point of it. The point of it seems to be reminding the worshiper that God is the giver of all that sustains life, of all, not only the animals that help us sustain life, but all the grain, all that we eat. And so they're giving a portion of that to the Lord and sacrificing that. It's a reminder of that. So they bring that. Now here is three sections, verse 4 through verse 10, is that which is cooked. And there are various ways to cook that. So here would be an offering that would be baked in an oven. What do we know about that? Just one verse. Say again. Yeah, it's to be mixed with oil or unleavened wafers anointed with oil. More about the leaven a little bit later at verse 11. Then the next baked or cooked would be baked in a pan. Your footnote may say griddle or flat plate. And it was to be a fine flour, unleavened. Notice again the unleavened. And they'll break it in pieces, pour oil on it, and it's a grain offering. So they're bringing this grain offering if it's cooked this way. There's another way it could be cooked, verses 7 through 10. In a covered pan. And they present it to the priest, and he brings it to the altar. I'm reading now at verse 9. The priest shall take from the grain a memorial portion and burn it, just like we saw a moment ago. That's a sweet-smelling aroma. And then what's left would be for Aaron and his sons. And it's the most holy offering that to the Lord. Making sense? So there were at least four different ways that a grain offering could be offered. Now, the specific application may be mentioned later. We're not interested in that now, or we may be interested. Maybe I shouldn't word it that way. But we're not going to cover that right now. We're just looking at the manual. Here's how these are to be offered. Make sense? All right. Now let's start with the restrictions section, 11 to 13. What do we see in the restrictions? All right. Leaven is a corrupting influence. And so this is to be without corruption. And so that's a reminder of purity among the people. And it's not to be made with honey, something fermented. Nor, notice at verse 12, if you offer your first fruits, which we haven't got to yet, what do we know about those? Not to be burned on the altar for a sweet aroma. So here's some restrictions. If I don't learn anything else, I may not understand why. I think I understand why on the leaven and the honey, and also the next restriction there is not to be burned. But whether I understand why God does that doesn't matter. That God sets restrictions and said it's not to be burned. This is not to be with honey. This is not to be with leaven. And so I don't have to understand why. I just need to pay attention to what God does. Now there is something, though, that is to always be done. Verse 13. Add salt, a preserving effect. So this is interesting. God doesn't want, as you bring your sacrifices, some corrupting influence in the sacrifice, but he does want a preserving influence. There ought to be some lesson in that for the people of God as they bring their sacrifices before God. And so it was to be seasoned with salt. You shall not allow the salt of the covenant of your God to be lacking in your grain offerings. So make sure it's there. So here's some restrictions. Here's something you always have. Here's something you never have in that sacrifice. Again, this is the manual. So whether we remember that or not, if we want to know about the grain offering, go back to the manual and see what was permitted, what was not. All right, let's get one more section in chapter 2. Beginning at verse 14, here's the first fruits. What do we know about the first fruits? What is first fruits, by the way? The New Testament uses that language saying Christ is the first fruits of those that rose from the dead. What's the first fruits? Yeah. Yeah, it's the first crop you have. And so If you're raising some crop and the first group that you have and the first ripen, you would think that's what you want to keep for yourself. If you were raising a few tomato plants and your first ripened tomato, you probably wouldn't want to give to me. You want to keep that for yourself, don't you? You want that. You may give me one, but you're not going to probably give me your first ones. Well, you give your first ones to the Lord. Now, interesting about this is another statement. Not only is it to be the first fruits, but what else do you see at verse 14? The grain was to come from full heads. That sounds like the expression we saw earlier, without blemish. So you're giving your best bull, you're giving your best goat, you're giving your best lamb, and now when you get your grain, you're going to give the fullest heads, from full heads, your best. You're going to give that to the Lord of the first fruits. And you'll put oil and lay frankincense on it. What else do we know about this sacrifice? Yeah, the priest shall burn a memorial section. Part of it was beaten, and et cetera, as an offering made by fire to the Lord. So again, this is our manual for the grain offering. How was it, what's to be offered? How is it to be offered? And if it was baked in the oven, so you come bringing to the priest, here's this offering that was baked in the oven. This was baked in a covered pan. This one is not baked at all, not cooked at all. Here's how that's to be done. Make sense? So, all right. So we may not remember the details of all of that, but if you want to take a quick look over at chapter 6, beginning at verse 14, just to see how many verses are dealt with there, we're going to get into that next time. 6, beginning at verse 14, here's the grain offering. A little more information given there. And it goes all the way down through verse 23. And for example, verse 23 says, every grain offering for the priest shall be wholly burnt, and it shall not be eaten. So there were certain sacrifices that could be eaten and some that could not be eaten. We'll see more about that distinction a little bit later. Now, 6 months from now, you won't remember. But this is the manual where we go back and see if we want to flag that. Make sense? All right, let's go to chapter 3 now. What do we have in chapter 3? Peace offering. Now we skip a chapter, by that I mean we go to chapter 7. We're going to come back to the rest of chapter 6 a little later, but we're jumping over to chapter 7 and we will go there to get some information a little bit later. So here are three things. The peace offering could be of your herd, like the burnt offering. It could be of your flock, goats or lamb, and they were not to eat fat or blood, verse 17, one verse devoted to that. Now, so what is the peace offering? Well, some refer to this as the offering of thanksgiving. So I want to get ahead of ourselves. Let's jump on over to chapter 7, where this is discussed more fully. We'll get this next time. And so let's jump over to chapter 7, beginning at verse 11. This seemed to be a sacrifice that you offered to God that was symbolic of the festive joy of those that were at peace with God. Not so much to bring peace with God. There are other sacrifices that may accomplish that. But it seemed to be a celebration of your peace with God. And it seemed to be a celebration of thanksgiving. And you say, well, what makes you think that? I didn't see that in chapter 3. We see that in chapter 7. So beginning at verse 11, I'm not going to read all of that. It talks about the peace offering which you shall offer. Notice verse 12 talks about if he offers it for a thanksgiving. This peace offering could be offered for thanksgiving, a celebration. We see that again at verse 15. The flesh of the sacrifice of his peace offering for thanksgiving shall be eaten on the same day that it's offered. Shall not leave it until morning. And on through chapter 7, beginning at verse 11 through 21. So that's where that chapter will be helpful to us in interpreting this. Make sense? So it was a celebration, seemingly, an offering of thanksgiving. All right, let's go to our questions. Question number 4, what was the peace offering? Say again. All right. Could be a male or female from the herd without blemish. So let's subdivide this now, and let's talk about the peace offering from the herd, that is, from the cattle. So notice this peace offering, if it's from the herd, it could be male or female. Now, that's not true of all sacrifices, but it was of this one. And so again, our manual is telling us, okay, either one would be acceptable. And again, without blemish, the best before the Lord. If we learn nothing else, we learn a powerful lesson there. Starting at verse 2, here's how it's to be offered. What's to be done? All right. Very good. Yeah, let's take that a point at a time. Let's look at verse 2. Good summary. That he lays his hand, the man who brings it lays his hand, and he kills it at the door of the tabernacle. Then they take the blood. What do they do with it? Right. What altar? Altar, burnt offering on the outside of the tabernacle within the courtyard. And he offers, he shall offer a sacrifice for a peace offering. And what do they do with the fat that covers the entrails, etc., and the kidneys, etc.? They're going to take all of that, and what are they going to do with it? Going to burn it on the altar, on the wood, an offering made by fire, which is a sweet aroma to the Lord. All right. So that's his peace offering if it's from the herd. All right. Now then, it could be from the flock, and if it's of a lamb, now notice it, verse 6, he could take it from the flock. Could it be male or female? Yes, it could be either one, and it also was to be without blemish, the best he had. I'm learning about the principle of sacrifice. We come to the New Testament, we're going to read about sacrifice, sacrificing to the Lord, sacrifice, sacrifice, over and over again. And you say, well, I don't understand the principle of sacrifice. Well, we're learning right here, sacrifice means a sacrifice. You're giving up something of value. It costs you something. They're giving their best. Now, concerning the lamb, they're going to lay their hand on it, and they're going to kill it before the tabernacle of meeting. And Aaron's going to take, and his sons, Aaron's sons will take the blood and do what with it? Yeah, sprinkle it all around on the altar. And so he's going to offer this peace offering. What do they do with the fat? Same thing. Take all the fat, and when they get all the fat out of that, they're going to take that and burn it on the altar, made by fire to the Lord. Now, beginning at verse 12, it might be a goat they bring. And what about the goat? All right, yeah, offer, if the offering is a goat, and I take implied, though it's not mentioned specifically here, that it's like the lamb, could be male or female, but also to be without blemish. So it's not stated, it's in this statement of the flock. I think that's implied, but if you think not, then have at that. Beginning at verse 13, how is this to be offered? Okay. Yes, they lay their hands on it, they offer it, and took all the fat thereof, and then they burn that on the altar. Now, what's not mentioned here, this is where chapter 7 is going to be helpful to us. Let's go to chapter 7, beginning at verse 14. And you say, I didn't see anything what's to be done with the rest of that animal. Let's go see. This is where chapter 7, and making a marginal note that we need to go over and see chapter 7 at verses 14 through 16, that they shall offer, make sure I got the right chapter, chapter 7, beginning of verse 14, that the flesh of the sacrifice of peace offering at the same day shall not be left unborn, but the sacrifice shall be voluntarily, shall be eaten the same day. In other words, what I wanted you to see over there, make sure I had the right verses 14 to 16 of chapter 7, the remainder of the flesh could be eaten by the worshiper and the priest. They would split that. We didn't learn that from chapter 3. We learned that from chapter 7. That's why it helps to take other accounts into our study. So we'll capture that next time. You say, oh, I didn't catch all of that when you went over to chapter 7. We'll get that next time. I just wanted you to know chapter 7 is going to give me more information about what's to be done with the rest. What do they do with the rest of it? They burn all the fat. What do we do with the rest of it? Well, chapter 7 is going to tell us. And that, so the priest gets part of that and the worshiper gets part of that. Now let's go to the last verse, and we got to pick our pace up a little bit. What we see in the last verse? I could eat fat or blood. Now, not told here, chapter 17 of this book is going to tell us life is in the blood, and so there's no eating of blood. So don't eat the fat or eat the blood. All right, let's go quickly to chapter 4. Here's a sin offering. And let me mention two or three things quickly, I think, to capture the thought. I didn't realize our time. We got about four minutes. Let's see if we can capture the thought. Now, we back up to chapter 6 as the parallel account, by the way. We're not going to go there. We don't really need to make our point, except verse 26. You might flag verse 26, and we'll say more about that here in just a second. This seems to be a, well, not seems to be, this is a sin offering, an offering for sin. And as I've outlined it here, he seems to focus on the individual, then the whole congregation, and then a ruler, and then the common people, various people who commit sin. It might be an individual person who sins, an unintentional sin. I take that it's a sin that it could be a sin that he is unaware that he did it, or it could be that he's unaware that what he did was wrong. But I think verse 14, verse 23, verse 28 gives us a little information about that. It's an unintentional sin. Then it comes to his knowledge. Knowledge that he did it or knowledge that it was sinful. Could be either one. Pulpit and Colin Daitlich both suggest that that involves far more than just a sin of ignorance. It's sin of inadvertence, sin of weakness, anything in contrast to a high-handed sin. I'll leave that for you to pursue their thoughts on that. But anyway, verse 3 talks about an anointed priest. The anointed priest refers to the high priest. I know that because the anointed priest is to take and offer the sacrifice in the most holy place. That's a high priest. So it could be the high priest himself sins, verses 3 to 12. And so what he does is he kills the bull and he takes it in and to the tabernacle of meeting and dips his finger and sprinkles some of it before the veil, etc. And then there may be a sacrifice needed for the whole congregation. You say, how did the whole congregation sin? Well, the whole congregation sinned in the case of, for example, rebelling against Rehoboam in 2 Samuel, 1 Kings chapter 12, or being afraid of Goliath. They were all afraid. That they do that as a group. As a whole, they go forth. Daniel 9 talks about the same principle. The thing could be hidden from their eyes, verse 13, in the sense they were deceived. The whole nation could be deceived, being misled by false prophets. And here is what is to be done with that. I'm driving to make a marginal note here, and so get ready to make a marginal note that'll be helpful right here from chapter 6. The ruler probably has reference to a king, verse 22, leaders of the tribes, perhaps judges, and here's what they were to offer. And then there's common people. That's anyone that's not under some authority. A sacrifice, sin offerings to be made for them. Now here's the point I want us to flag. If the blood was taken into the tabernacle, the sacrifice could not be eaten. You say, where'd you learn that? From chapter 6, verse 26. So make a marginal note if you're so disposed to do that. Chapter 6, verse 26, if the blood of the sacrifice was taken into the tabernacle, they could not eat that meat. If it wasn't, case in point, the sacrifice before the ruler. They would take the blood and offer it and put it on the horns of the altar of burnt offering. That was on the outside of the tabernacle. That could be eaten. Does that make sense? But if the blood was taken into the tabernacle, like the case of the one for the high priest, they couldn't eat that. Make sense? So what was the distinction? Whether the blood went in before the tabernacle, chapter 6. All right. Questions or comments? Our time is gone. We hurriedly looked at chapter 4. When we get to chapter 6, we'll tie chapter 4 back with that and hopefully thread that together a little better. We'll stop right there.